the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, American drug maker Merck has agreed to let some companies produce its experimental COVID-19 pill. The move, announced Wednesday by a health organization supported by the United Nations, is aimed at helping people in poorer countries to get the drug. The medicine's patent pool, or MPP, said in a joint statement that the agreement will make the drug molnupiravir available in 105 low- and middle-income countries. The drug also will need approval from local health officials. Under the agreement, the health agency is permitted to license qualified companies to manufacture the antiviral drug. Merck and its partners, Ridgeback Biotherapeutics and Emory University in Georgia, will not receive money for sales of molnupiravir as long as the World Health Organization considers COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern. In early October, Merck reported that its experimental pill reduced hospitalizations and deaths by half among people infected with COVID-19 in a drug trial. The company is asking health officials in the United States and around the world to approve the pill for treatment of coronavirus infections. Pfizer and Roche, two other drug companies, are also working on similar COVID-19 pills. But molnupiravir could be the first pill approved for the treatment of COVID-19. A pill can be taken at home and is easier to send around the world. All other approved COVID-19 treatments must be injected by healthcare workers. Charles Gore is the executive director of MPP. He said early results of the drug were compelling. Gore said the pill is an important tool to help deal with the current health crisis. He said he hoped the agreement will lead to others. The nonprofit group Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF, welcomed the agreement to share Merck's COVID-19 pill. But it said the license doesn't go far enough. Yuan Cheong-hu is a senior legal and policy advisor with MSF. She said the license does not include nearly half of the world's population in countries like Brazil and China. The two also have strong, established capacity to produce and supply antiviral medicines. Who noted the license would also limit the production and supply of more affordable and available generic molnupiravir. Merck said earlier that it could produce 10 million treatments of the pill this year. The treatment requires 2 pills a day for 5 days. The U.S. has already purchased 1.7 million treatments at the cost of $700 each. The company is also working with several Indian companies to license cheaper, generic versions of molnupiravir for low- and middle-income countries. Researchers at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health estimated that a generic version could cost less than $20 for each treatment.
Voters in the American state of Maine decide next week if all its people should be permitted to grow food crops and raise farm animals or livestock. Supporters of the Right to Food constitutional amendment say it will put people in control of how and what they eat. Opponents argue it will endanger the state's animals and food supplies and turn city neighborhoods into cow fields. The vote is set for November 2nd. Most food produced in the U.S. comes from commercial farms. Private citizens who want to grow their own food usually live in rural areas. Laws like the one being considered in Maine permit people to grow their own food, including cows and chickens, on their property. Ron Falkingham is a Maine state lawmaker and a fisherman. He says big businesses control too much of the food supply in the U.S. We want to protect people's ability to grow gardens, grow and raise their own food, he said. People who do not think the law is a good idea say the food supply needs safety rules. Julianne Smith leads the Maine Farm Bureau, the state's largest special interest group representing the agriculture industry. She argues that the proposed law is, in her words, so broad and dangerous, it could make the food supply less safe. That is a problem in a state where potatoes, blueberries, maple syrup, and dairy products are all important parts of the economy, she said. The amendment could empower people in the state to buy and eat food that has not been inspected for safety, Smith suggested. Most Maine towns and cities have rules called ordinances that restrict agricultural operations. Smith said she thinks the proposed amendment, if passed, could weaken local ordinances. But Representative Falkingham says local rules would continue to be enforced under the amendment. The push for people to grow their own food with limited restrictions is called the Food Sovereignty Movement. Supporters include some owners of small farms and people who seek unprocessed food products like raw milk. Activists for limited government and those opposed to powerful corporate control of the food supply are also in favor of the amendment. I'm Dan Friedel.
Blue Origin is the latest American company to announce plans to develop a private space station. The company and its partners said this week that the station, called Orbital Reef, will be operated as a mixed-use business park in space. Blue Origin's main partner will be Sierra Space, a part of U.S.-based defense contractor Sierra Nevada Corporation. The project is also backed by Boeing, Arizona State University, and other companies. In a statement, Sierra Space said Orbital Reef aims to open up new markets in space and provide individuals and companies the chance to establish their own address on orbit. The company aims to begin operating Orbital Reef between 2025 and 2030. The station plans to stay in low Earth orbit at about 500 kilometers, which is higher than the International Space Station. The developers say Orbital Reef will support 10 people in an area of about 830 cubic meters, nearly the size of the ISS. It will serve a range of private customers. This could include science researchers, space agencies, nations without space programs, and technology and manufacturing companies. Space tourists would also be able to visit Orbital Reef. The visitors would be able to enjoy clear views of Earth and would experience 32 sunrises and sunsets each day, Blue Origin said in an online fact document. Brent Sherwood is Senior Vice President of Advanced Development Programs for Blue Origin. He said the past development of flight vehicles and space stations by NASA and other space agencies had prepared the way for private space stations to become a reality. Now, Orbital Reef will seek to expand access, lower the cost, and provide all the services and amenities needed to normalize spaceflight, Sherwood said. Blue Origin has already launched a space tourism service that provides rides to the edge of space aboard its rockets and spacecraft capsule. The flights permit passengers to experience a few minutes of weightlessness and observe Earth from afar. Lindy Elkins Tanton is vice president of the Interplanetary Initiative at Arizona State University. She has been involved in planning Orbital Reef. In a Blue Origin video, Elkins Tanton said she sees the project as a kind of space village. Think of it as many different organizations and people in their own parts of Orbital Reef, doing their own activities, she added. Sherwood said that the station's developers will work hard to make sure that Orbital Reef is not just for the entities that have had access to space so far. Instead, he said it will be designed to be humanity's footprint in low Earth orbit. And that means all the nations and companies and peoples of the world. Sierra Space has also been developing a space plane called Dream Chaser. It has been awarded a NASA contract to perform at least 7 supply missions to the ISS beginning as soon as next year, the company announced in April. Orbital Reef is one of several private space stations planned in the coming years as the future of the aging ISS is unclear. The ISS project is set to end in 2024 unless its international partners approve new financing to keep it going. NASA officials have signaled that a continuation of the ISS beyond 2024 is likely. But NASA also holds a contract with a company called Axiom to develop a new space station that will first be attached to the ISS before becoming free-flying. The ISS's other main supporter, Russia, has said it is considering quitting the project as early as 2025 to build its own space station. China's space agency has already deployed a new space station and sent astronauts to visit it earlier this year. The plans for private space stations have been welcomed by NASA, which announced this year it plans to award up to $400 million in contracts for such projects. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On a cold and cloudy day in March of 1861, Abraham Lincoln became the 16th President of the United States. In his inaugural speech, the new president announced the policy that he would follow toward the southern states that had left the Union. Lincoln said, no state had a legal right to secede. The Union could not be broken. He said he would enforce federal laws in every state. And he promised not to surrender any federal property in the states that seceded. Lincoln said if force was necessary to protect the Union, then force would be used. His policy was soon tested. Jack Weitzel and Jack Moyles discuss the dispute over the federal base that was being built at Fort Sumter.
On his second day as president, Lincoln received some bad news from Fort Sumter at Charleston, South Carolina. Major Robert Anderson, the commander of the small United States force at Sumter, wrote that his food supplies were low. At most, said Anderson, there was enough food for 40 days. Unless he and his men received more supplies, they would have to leave the fort. Lincoln wanted to keep Fort Sumter. It was one of the few United States forts in the South still held by federal forces, and he had promised not to give up any federal property in the states that seceded.
But getting food to Fort Sumter would be a very difficult job. The fort was built on an island in Charleston Harbor. It was surrounded by southern artillery. Southern gunboats guarded the port. To get supplies to Anderson and his men, a ship would have to fight its way to Sumter. Such a battle was sure to begin a bitter civil war. There also was the danger that fighting would cause slave states still in the Union to secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
The Army Chief, General Scott, warned Lincoln that it was too late to get supplies to Fort Sumter. He said southern defenses around the fort were so strong that a major military effort would be necessary. He said it would take months to prepare the warships and soldiers for such an effort. Major Anderson and his men at Sumter, he said, could not wait that long. There was another plan, however, that might work. It was proposed to Lincoln by Captain Gustavus Fox of the Navy Department. Captain Fox said soldiers and supplies could be sent down to Charleston in ships. Outside the entrance to the harbor, on a dark night, they could be put into small boats and pulled by tugs to the fort. Fox said a few warships could be sent to prevent southern gunboats from interfering.
Lincoln liked this plan. He asked his cabinet for advice. If it were possible to send supplies to Sumter, he asked, would it be wise to do so? Postmaster General Blair was the only member of the cabinet to answer yes. Treasury Secretary Chase was for the plan only if Lincoln was sure it would not mean war. Secretary of State Seward and the others opposed it. They said it would be better to withdraw Major Anderson and his men. They felt that now was not the time to start a civil war. This opposition in the cabinet caused Lincoln to postpone action on the Fox Plan. But he sent two men separately to Charleston to get him information on the situation there. One was Captain Fox. The other was a close friend, Ward Lamon.
In Charleston, Fox met with Governor Pickens. He explained that he wished to talk with Major Anderson, not to give him orders, but to find out what the situation really was. Governor Pickens agreed. A Confederate boat carried Fox to Sumter. Anderson told Fox that the last of the food would be gone on April 15th. Ward Lamon went to Charleston after Fox returned to Washington. He, too, met with Governor Pickens and Major Anderson. The South Carolina governor asked Lamon to give Lincoln this message. Nothing can prevent war except a decision by the President of the United States to accept the secession of the South. If an attempt is made to put more men in Fort Sumter, a war cry will be sounded from every hilltop and valley in the South. Lamon reported to Lincoln that the arrival of even a boatload of food at Sumter would lead to fighting.
At the end of March, Lincoln held another cabinet meeting and again asked what should be done about Fort Sumter. Should an attempt be made to get supplies to Major Anderson? This time, three members of the cabinet voted yes and three voted no. When the meeting ended, Lincoln wrote an order for the Secretary of War. He told him to prepare to move men and supplies by sea to Fort Sumter. He said they should be ready to sail as early as April 6th, only 1 week away.
On April 4th, Lincoln called Captain Fox to the White House. He told him that the government was ready to take supplies to Fort Sumter. He said Fox would lead the attempt. Lincoln showed Fox a message he was sending to Governor Pickens in South Carolina. It read, "This is to inform you that an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with food only. If this attempt is not opposed, no effort will be made to throw in men, arms, or ammunition." Governor Pickens received the message on April 8th. He immediately sent it by telegraph to Confederate President Jefferson Davis at Montgomery, Alabama. Davis called a meeting of his cabinet to discuss what should be done. He asked if Fort Sumter should be seized before supplies could arrive.
Former United States Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia was the Confederate Secretary of State. He told Davis, "Firing upon that fort will begin a civil war greater than any the world has ever seen. I cannot advise you." Later in the meeting, Toombs urged Davis not to attack the fort. "Mr. President," he said, "at this time it is suicide, murder, and will lose us every friend in the North. You will strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountains to oceans. Millions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is not necessary. It puts us in the wrong. It will kill us."
On April 10th, Jefferson Davis sent his decision to the Confederate commander at Charleston, General Pierre Beauregard. He told Beauregard to demand the surrender of Fort Sumter. If Major Anderson refused, then the general was to destroy the fort. The surrender demand was carried to Sumter the next day by a group of Confederate officers. They said Anderson and his men must leave the fort, but they could take with them their weapons and property. And they were offered transportation to any United States port they named.
Anderson rejected the demand. As he walked with the Confederate officers back to their boat, he asked if General Beauregard would open fire on Sumter immediately. "No," they said. "He would be told later when the shooting would start." Anderson then told the Southerners, "If you do not shell us to pieces, hunger will force us out in a few days." General Beauregard informed the Confederate government in Montgomery that Anderson refused to surrender. He also reported the major's statement that Sumter had only enough food for a few more days.
New orders were sent to Beauregard. Jefferson Davis said there was no need to attack the fort if hunger would soon force the United States soldiers to leave. But he said Anderson must say exactly when he and his men would leave. And he said Anderson must promise not to fire on Confederate forces. If Anderson agreed to this, then Confederate guns would remain silent. This offer was carried to Fort Sumter a few minutes before midnight, April 11th. Anderson discussed the offer with his officers and then wrote his answer. He would leave the fort on April 15th if the Confederates made no hostile act against Fort Sumter or against the United States flag. He would not leave, however, if before then he received new orders or supplies.
This did not satisfy the three Confederate officers who brought Beauregard's message. They handed Anderson a short note. It said, "We have the honor to inform you that General Beauregard will open fire on Fort Sumter in 1 hour, at 4:20, on the morning of April 12, 1861. The major shook hands with Beauregard's representatives, and they left the fort. Anderson and his officers woke their men and told them to prepare for battle. At Fort Johnson, across the harbor, Confederate gunners also were getting ready. These men would fire the first shot at Sumter. That explosion would signal the other guns surrounding the fort to open fire.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.